Archie Farron is being interviewed by Renee Garlick for Concord's oral history program, sponsored by the Concord Historical Commission. The interview is being conducted at his home at 185 Central Street on December 1st, 1977. Mr. Farron is 72 years old. Were you aware of West Concord as a separate entity while you were growing up?
Well, there's no doubt about it being separate, almost separate entities. Although it was both ends of town that Concord. The people in the old Concord, as we used to call it, very often let us know one way or the other that we were living on the other side of the railroad track. It wasn't called West Concord at that time. It was called Concord Junction. That was because the New Haven Railroad and the Boston and Maine crossed. Where the railroad station was.
What brought you to Concord Center?
Pardon me?
Well, you were growing up as boys. What would have brought you to Concord Center?
Well, one of the things was the rivalry between the two ends of town and sports. At the time when I was a youngster, eight and on, we had a very good playground program. Had some very good instructors. I remember one instructor at the playgrounds was also a second grade teacher in Concord Junction. Another on the sports end,
baseball was very big.
Baseball was a big sport in those days. We had a fellow named Chink Murray who took the job in at the playground in the summertime. He afterwards became a coach at Western Reserve College, a university out in Ohio. He was a very good baseball player himself, understood the game, taught us the finer points. Then, of course, downtown they had the same program. So the games between the youngsters, and it was divided into three different age groups. There was the youngsters, and then there was what you call the junior crowd and the senior crowd. And those the youngsters were 10 to 12 years old, the junior crowd from there to about 15, and then the seniors were the boys over 15.
Did it draw a large audience?
Well, for those games between the youngsters, yeah, quite a number of people would come down to watch the series, especially the final one if it was a rubber game. But the larger crowds were brought in by the fact that we had town teams, and that is adults that play. And I've seen as many as 5,000 spectators at the Percy Rideout Playground on the occasion of big games. Usually those came in the fall or late in the summer, early fall, maybe latter part of August to September. And also around 4th of July, either here at the Percy Rideout Playground or the old fairgrounds. An uncle of mine was the manager and also the financial godfather for the team at this end of the town. because baseball was a professional baseball, especially, was not allowed to play on Sundays. He would go in on Friday to Fenway Park and find out if the Red Sox or the visiting team had a pitcher that was going to lose his place in rotation, in which case the manager of the team would allow that pitcher or the pitcher and catcher to accept a honorarium of about $100 to come out and play for the team in Wisconsin. And of course, that's how I got to see some of the great ball players of the early 1900s. There probably aren't too many of us left now that can remember the Duffy, Speaker, Hooper outfield of the Red Sox, but I have vivid memories of those folks, especially Chris Speaker and Ty Cobb. Speaker was the center fielder for the Red Sox, and Ty Cobb, one of the all great outfielder of all times, a pretty scrappy guy. You could count on Fenway Park being full when the Detroit Tigers were in. And on those occasions, there were several people here in town who worked for Old Colony Trust, which has now been merged with the First National Bank. And these employees, the Old Colony Trust Company had a ball team, a company team, and the rivalry was exaggerated by the fact that there was so many men who lived here in Concord and worked for Old Colony. And the games between the Concord Junction team and teams like the Old Colony, company teams, was arranged generally for them to come out on holidays, 4th of July celebrations or Labor Day celebrations. I do recall one, I think it was in 1912 on the old fairgrounds, and tents were erected way out in the outfield when the baseball game was going on at the same time. So because of the tents, they had to have some ground rules. And one of the ground rules was that if a ball would hit one of the tents, it was to be ruled a two-base hit, regardless of where it went. In other words, if it went, the reason for it, if it had gone under the tent, the outfielder would have absolutely no chance of getting it before it became a home run. My uncle was the manager that day, and Billy Bulger, a very good ball player, especially for an amateur, and might have played in leagues if he really tried. He hit one over the fence, over the tents. Well, no one had ever expected a ball to go over the fence, over the tent. So he went all the way around, and my uncle went out, and they argued about it, and they said, well, the ground rules was that any ball that went beyond the place where the outfielder could catch it was ruled a two-bagger. And it caused quite a bit of controversy. The game was held up for 15 or 20 minutes while that argument went on. But my Uncle Archie won the argument, and Bill Bulger was sent back to second base. And I remember some 30 or 40 years afterwards, my Uncle Archie and Bill Bulger met downtown and got talking old times. Archie said, Bill, you know, that was the longest hit I ever saw in my life. And if there was ever a home run hit in Concord, that was it. But rules are rules.
For Red Sox games, did you get the scores at the railroad station?
Oh, yeah. Especially World Series. You'd be down there on the telegrapher for the railroad, but he wasn't taking instructions on how the trains were to be switched to one thing or another. The takeoff on his telegraph instruments, the scores by the innings were what happened. Of course, we were always running behind, maybe an inning or two, and sometimes three innings. But that was in those days, that was a lot better than waiting the next day to read it in the newspapers. So there was always quite a gathering down there on the World Series. And also the championship prize fights. Those came over the wire, and the telegrapher at the station would take those down and read them out to us. The one that was most vividly in my memory was the Jack Johnson fight in Havana, Cuba. How they accomplished that one, I don't know. There must have been 100 of us down there, all ages, because I was a youngster and on up into much older people. But again, it was, because we had no radio, no TV, and this was the best that was available at the time.
Do you recall the strawberry farms? Do you remember them?
Oh, yeah. I picked strawberries here. Of course, the one that I wanted to pick strawberries for the most, because it was almost my own backyard, was a field owned by Abel Chase. And he was one of the biggest growers in this area. He had a strawberry field and what was afterwards the Percy Rideout playground. And he also had one, well, it was off Central Street and ran down through what is now Chase Road. And of course, it being so near the home, I thought I might get a chance to pick strawberries there, but I was always somehow or other considered too young or inexperienced to one thing or another.
Did the reformatory have industry at that time?
Well, they had several. There was a woolen mill and a furniture factory, a shoe shop.
So they employed quite a number of people within the town.
Well, they had most of the instructors lived here. One superintendent of the woolen mill was Jim Dunlap, who lived on Main Street in Concord Junction. Another fellow that I remember was connected to the woolen mill was Mr. McKenzie, and I can't remember his first name. He had a son, Ronald, who was in school with me. Bricklaying was taught, and that instructor was named Mr. Wilson. The chief, the instructor for the chair factory. I'm not sure.
Some say.
I'll try to tell you his name, but I've forgotten it.
Some say all roads in Conca Junction led to the fire station.
Well, for kids it did. When the fire whistle blew, and it was an all-volunteer department, even including the horses that were used to draw the fire apparatus. Ed Camo, Charlie Camo's father, had two marvelous horses. One was Tom, and the other
Barney.
Tom and Barney. And when the whistle blew, no matter where those horses were located or working, they unhitched from whatever they were drawing at the time, and they ran at as fast a pace as they could to the fire station, which was later burned down. You might find from some of the others around town a story about that. But there's a small parking lot there now. Well, anyway, Tom and Barney would arrive, and they'd hitch up to the fire apparatus, and off they went to the fire. But one of the comical situations that I remember was when, along in the middle teens, the town acquired a motorized truck. And in the summer, I think it was about 1915, fire whistle blew. Because there was no school, the area around the fire station was soon filled with youngsters wanting to see the fire and the apparatus and so on. And Silas Bean was the chief of the fire department then, so of course the chief was the one who was going to drive the truck. I imagine anybody who contradicted his judgment that he was the best driver would be in trouble. So Cy Bean, they opened the door, and Cy Bean was in the truck and started out and got onto the apron in front of the fire station and stopped. And he got out of the fire truck, lifted up the genuine leather seats of the driver, reached underneath and got some long leather gauntlets, and here it was, it must have been 80 degrees, and he put those on, put the seat back in place, and got up and went off to the fire. I always wondered if Cy ever thought that you didn't need gauntlets when the temperature was in the 80s. That also turned out to be comical when they finally hitched up the hose to the hydrants, and they waved to go ahead and tell the fellow standing at the hydrants to open it up so the water would come through the hose. Nothing happened. So they tried again. In their attempt to let the people at the hydrant know, the firemen attending the hydrant know that he wasn't getting any water, he more or less let go of the hose, and just then the water came through. So we had about 200 feet of fire hose snapping around like a snake. Of course, all that water went on the streets, and the fire, which was at the laundry off Commonwealth Avenue. Well, they lost the building.
It was almost like a Keystone Comedy.
Yeah, it was really a Keystone. That was one of the better than the movies. It was the actual thing. They didn't have to pay a dime to see it.
You later became a newspaper man for the Boston Globe. What newspapers were read in the earlier part of the century by Concordians?
Well, in the early days, there were several papers in Boston. There was a Transcript, which was read by those who were interested. One in the social activities of the Boston area and outside, and also they had a prestigious financial section. Then there was the Post, which was the publisher of that was Mr. Grosher, who originally came from, I think, Portland, Maine. The Post, for the most part, was the Democratic paper. The Post supported Democratic candidates. And then there was the Globe, which in the early part of the 1900s was the largest paper, the largest in circulation, which subsequently lost that title. For years, they carried a caricature of a man whose belly was like the globe, divided out with longitude and latitude. And of course, when they lost some of their circulation later on, that character had to be dropped. In other words, it was no longer the globe is no longer the largest circulation.
Was the Herald?
The Boston Herald. Herald and Travel. The Herald was the morning paper, the Traveler the evening paper. That paper supported Republican candidates. The Globe tried to stay more or less neutral, which was inclined to be rather a difficult job. The editorial section could be made neutral, but a great many times, because some of these reporters and city editors were kind of leaning towards Democratic candidates, that neutrality slipped.
What was the local newspaper?
The one I remember about. The Enterprise. I'm not sure whether there was another one at that time or not, but the Enterprise, which was published or printed in Marlborough, had the largest circulation on the continent. And then somewhere along in the 30s, another paper was started, and their office was down in the old railroad station off Lowell Road. Later on, that was sold to Sam Kemp. I wish I could remember the editor's name. He was quite a character. But in those days, in the 30s, I was working in Boston at the Globe those days, so the amount of time that I was able to spend in Concord was more or less in a horizontal position. I slept here and spent the rest of my time elsewhere.
The Depression, did it seem to hit Concord as hard as it did Boston that you were with?
No, most of the people in Concord had no real concept of the agony that the depression caused. Because it was difficult to get back and forth where you work at nights, and you never knew what you might have to work overtime, a story coming in late. I lived in Boston during the week. I had a place with another fellow who worked at the Globe, a fellow by the name of Arthur Griffin, who afterwards became a very well-known photographer. But on finishing the night's work, that meant that I would walk through Boston Common, on up through the Wilson Street, and there was as many as 2,000 living on the common. And they used to divide up into small teams, like 10 or 12 fellows. They would go down at one place where they got a pretty good haul of food, was old Thompson Spire in Newspaper Row. And Thompson Spire closed at about 11 o'clock, or a little after 11, and put their garbage bills out into City Hall Avenue. And these unfortunates who were living on the Boston Common would show up in City Hall Avenue waiting for the garbage bills to put out, because they could, for them, they could get some pretty good food, sandwiches that were not sold, pieces of pie, spent coffee grounds, and the containers, they'd fill it up and feed it back to the common, where they had a chance to warm it up. They had fires there. Two or three items that they couldn't get was sugar, and salt, and milk. So passers-by that were going through the common might be approached by these fellows to ask if they had a nickel or a dime in which they could go and get a couple pounds of sugar to sweeten their coffee, or some salt to enhance the taste of the food that they had. And that was really tough times. And I think some of the people here in Concord, when I would tell them about that, thought that I was exaggerating, but this was no exaggeration whatsoever.
In Concord, the industry kept running?
Well, such industries we had. The woolen mill finally gave up. That was the woolen mill up in Damondale, as it was called, in Westvale. The woolen reprocessing plant owned by Dan and Dan Hayes, called the Concord Garnet Mills, that kept running. Of course, there was as far as the reformatories is concerned, business was just as good as it always ever was. So the instructors and officers who worked there were not out of work. Chair factory continued. Probably not as busy as they worked in various professions. We had bankers and stockbrokers and lawyers and all that, and they may have felt the depression in some ways, and that maybe their dividends were not as good as they had been in the 20s. But they still went up against it the way the people were in the city.
As a selectman from 1954 through 1958, town meetings and town affairs were of special concern to you. Do you recall the earlier town meetings?
Well, the first one I went to, I was a teenager, somewhere along the line. Those who couldn't vote were allowed to go into the, watch the town meeting from the balcony. So...
This is at the townhouse?
The first one that I recall was at the townhouse. It must have been a special town meeting because it was sometime along in June, if I recall. My special interest for going there was to hear Bob Bygrave, who was a lawyer, lived here in town, but had his office in Boston. He was a staunch Democrat, a real fighter, and I'd heard that he was going to speak at the special town meeting. Frankly, I can't remember what the issue was or anything else, but I wanted to hear Bob Bygrave. There weren't many Democrats in town at that time. As a matter of fact, they had a very difficult time in even having a Democrat committee, Democrat Party committee. They put all the Democrats in a telephone booth. But as I say, the first one that I went to was in the old, in what is now the townhouse, it was there. It was a small balcony where you could watch the proceedings. Later on, the Veterans Building, or what is now 51 Walden Street. And then, if a real controversy, several real controversial articles were coming up in the town meeting, it was switched over to the Armory on Everett Street. And there again, there was a balcony. So the younger people were allowed to go up in there. That balcony later was declared unsafe. So the practice of allowing spectators in was abolished.
Do you recall the moderator later on, Judge Kise?
Well, yeah, the first one that I remember was Judge Kise. In lots of ways, he was rather a dictatorial character. You could always go and talk with the judge and reason with him. And if he thought you had an ample reason, why? He could usually count on it being done. If he said so, that was it. Just for instance, when the Fowler Library was built at the western end of the town, this end of the town, it was placed so that it cut off a short cut that had been used across that particular piece of property. And those considerable uproar about having to walk down Main Street to church and turn left, where for years and years we walked diagonally across through the lot. The original plans called for a sidewalk from Main Street straight to the front door of the library. And that meant that anyone who was using what had been the old path would be walking across the lawn. So it was brought to the old judge's attention, and he came up. He came up to see what it was all about. Finally agreed there'd be three paths, one diagonally to the front door of the library, and another continuation of that out to Church Street, plus the sidewalk straight in from Main Street to the front door. As I say, the judge would listen to you, and he was a pretty convincing character, so that if he said okay, well, it was accomplished without any more argument.
Were the earlier town meetings spirited affairs?
Yeah, lots of them generated quite a bit of heat, sometimes some light. I think probably there was more light than heat, but because some of the town meetings were pretty much cut and dried affairs, there was a gentleman named Ed McKenna downtown, and he and the judge would cook up a deal where they would liven up town meetings by Ed McKenna either opposing or espousing something that the old judge was maybe for or against. And that argument would proceed. Of course, the judge, acting as moderator, couldn't get in on it, but there was always somebody willing to pick up the argument and debate with Ed McKenna. Of course, most people didn't know that was a prearranged argument, and it was only to keep the people awake, I suppose. Quite often, some of the matters that were brought up really didn't make much difference which way the vote went, but livened the affair up and kept the people awake, and kept them there instead of going home after, for instance, if a favorite, something that they favored, as soon as it was voted, they'd get up and go home and leave the rest of the business to those who stayed through. Ed McKenna was quite a guy. I had the opportunity to serve with Ed on the Registrar of Voters for several years. That's where I picked up some stories that I was too young to remember. He told me about, I think it was one of his first trips to Concord, when Ed McKenna came out to the 100th anniversary of the fight at the North Bridge. He told me about how he got back. The Southern Division Railroad that ran from Boston out to Arlington and Lexington and Bedford and into Concord, going up to the reformatory, and the day turned out to be rather bitterly cold in the evening. There were so many people here in town that the railroad couldn't take care of the number, so he, along with several hundred other people, rode on the roof of the passenger cars to get back to Boston.
As selectman, which issue would you say was the most significant you have to deal with during the 1950s?
Well, it's probably one that very few, if anybody, knows the whole story about the rebuilding of the old North Bridge. In 1955, there was a hurricane that did considerable amount of damage upstate and farther west. But as the torrents of water came down the Assabet and the Sudbury and flooded, did quite a bit of flooding in Concord. The damage was not very great. But debris coming down the the rivers, finally did in the piling on the old North Bridge, which was constructed in 1909 out of cement. Of course, a great many people were not particularly impressed by seeing a what is called the old North Bridge made out of constructed out of cement. But in the flood of the 55, the bridge itself being arched was actually holding up the piling. And they were the piles that were run into the riverbed were swinging free. So immediately we closed the bridge. This gave us an opportunity to think about having something that really looked like the old wooden bridge that was there in 1775. And Congress appropriated money. It was declared it is this part of Massachusetts and others in New England. Declared a disaster area, so there were funds available. But if you read the bill, you'd find that it was to replace damaged property. Also, in the case of the bridge, it had to be a bridge that was leading from one town to another, or connecting up with roads. Of course, the North Bridge connected up with nothing but the Minuteman statue. There was no the road beyond the statue had been given up years ago. So legally, the North Bridge did not qualify for the use of the funds. The other aspect of the thing was that the communities to the west of Concord had suffered tremendous damage. They had lost their bridges in some cases were completely swept away. They had no communication between one part of town and another. So, well, anxious about the North Bridge. We figured that the town would do a very good job on its own of rebuilding the bridge, or actually replacing it and having a replica rather than this atrocious thing that had been up there since 1909. But an official from the Commonwealth of Massachusetts and the federal administrator of these funds seemed very insistent that they be allowed to rebuild the bridge. And I couldn't understand why they were in such a great hurry, especially as winter came on. John Volpe, who was then a commissioner of public works, he came out here on a real cold, blustery day. He wanted to have pictures taken at the North Bridge and showing what we're going to do. We held a piece of paper there with something on it for publicity purposes. I don't know, I can't remember now, it was a picture of the bridge or what. So Elmer Jocelyn and I met him and had the picture taken. His public relations people were there. And it was all this hullabaloo. I was still insisting that we didn't want the bridge rebuilt, because all that meant was another cement bridge. And I arranged with the Globe that when the right opportunity came, we would get very indignant. The citizens of Concord would be very indignant about their rebuilding the North Bridge, because we wanted one made of wood and a replica along the lines of the model that was in the Antiquarian Society building. Well, finally the opportunity came and we unleashed the story, and the concept of having a replica made of wood was picked up across the country. Ralph McGill, who was then the editor of the Atlanta Constitution, wrote a very magnificent editorial on it, saying there was no doubt that was the way to do it. Other papers had articles on it. San Francisco Chronicle, I think it was, they had one. And others, the New York Times had a small article on it. So we seemed to be winning. But there seemed to still be this great hurry. Another publicity stunt was that was cooked up in Boston was to go in to see Christian Herder, then the governor of the Commonwealth. And we brought along a direct descendant, a youngster who was a direct descendant of Colonel Barrett, who had led the Minutemen at the North Bridge. Mrs. Hosmer, Gladys Hosmer, and a gentleman named Russ Cattell, who I did not know very well. And they asked that I go along. Well, I was working nights. That meant I would have very little sleep, so I tried to substitute one of the other members of the Board of Selectmen rather than the chairman. And when I suggested that, I got a call from the public relations man with the Department of Public Works that, now look, this is the governor that is asking you to come in, and you're certainly not going to allow anyone but the chairman. So I finally agreed. I'm trying to remember the fellow's last name, was public relations director, but his name was Francis something, Frank we called it. And he'd been a reporter previous to taking this job in the public works. So he finally persuaded me that was the thing to do. So sure enough, we went there, went to a 10 o'clock in the morning meeting with Governor Herder and John Bowlby and the delegation from Concord. More pictures are taken, and publicity releases and all this, that, and the other thing. I'm still wondering, what's this all about? We haven't even decided what kind of a bridge is going to be up there yet. But they more or less leaning our way that it would be a replica. Then it suddenly came out. I got talking with this fellow named Frank, who was the public relations director for John Bowlby. And here was the story. President Eisenhower had a heart attack, and it wasn't known definitely whether he would be able to run again for a second term. So John Bowlby wanted to be governor. Christian Herder was willing to run for President of the United States in case Eisenhower was not able to continue. And Christian Herder's campaign for the nomination would be touched off by the dedication of the North Bridge in Concord. So that was the reason that they were pressing to have the North Bridge all built, and they would go along with the replica, wood and all that, with the hopes that the dedication could take place in June. Well, subsequently it was discovered that Eisenhower was physically able to continue. Governor Herter, the chance of being nominated was lost to Governor Herter, and construction on the bridge slowed down. The dedication didn't take place till sometime in September of 56. That's one that very few people know about, because to protect my friend Frank at the Public Works Department, I kept it quiet.
Did the state finally build it?
The funds used were from the federal appropriation. I knew that it was as close a replica as we could come. They had quite a bit of difficulty getting ads men. They brought them in from such places as Essex and Ipswich, all the shipbuilders who knew how to chop the wood. So it
was. Was the wood specially treated wood?
Yeah, the process used was a process developed by Coppers Cope. Well, at that time, I don't know what they still do, but they had a plant up in Nashua, New Hampshire. Coppers Cope offered to supply the wood free of charge to the town of Concord. I never did find out, and frankly, I didn't care much as long as it was done that way. I didn't care whether Coppers gave it to the Commonwealth of Massachusetts or the federal government or not. They may have and they may have charged them for it. I never followed it through. But I was more or less laughed at, criticized, when I stated that the wooden bridge, properly constructed with the materials available at that time, would last longer than a cement bridge. And I'm still of the opinion that it'll be there a long, long time after anything else that might have been constructed or would have been gone, especially if it had been made out of cement again.
Well, that's a beautiful story. Sometimes an ordinary street has a story behind it.
Oh, yeah, that brings back to memory a little flurry that occurred at town meeting in the 50s when Joey D, who was the armorer, decided to sell part of the land that he owned off Bedford, along Bedford Street, and divided into house lots. So, you have to vote at town meeting the acceptance of a road and the name. So Joey named it Nancy, N-A-N-C-Y. And when that came up, one of our local historians opposed the name in that she thought the day of naming streets after persons of no particular historical significance to the town. But it was finally voted the name of Nancy. And a couple of weeks after town meeting was over, Joey D, who was a wonderful guy, had the story printed in the local papers of why the name Nancy. he was not naming it after his daughter Nancy. He was naming it after a village in France where during the First World War he had been stationed. It was a rest and recuperation area, I guess, in those days. After being at the front lines, the troops were sent back to this village where the villagers were extremely good to the troops that were stationed there. That kind of took the wind out of the sails of those who had opposed the name. In other words, they took for granted that there was another case of a person naming a street after a member of the family when it had nothing to do with it whatsoever.
Thank you.